When Donald Trump first refused to concede the election in 2020, Republicans in Congress didn't really know what to do with it. At the time, a lot of Republicans just kept their mouths shut, hoping that Trump would eventually give up. But there were also the Republicans who went all in, who started scheming with the Trump White House about how to keep Joe Biden from being certified as the duly elected president. And there was one congressman in particular who was way out in front of that effort, organizing a number of his colleagues to sign on to a highly dubious lawsuit challenging Biden's victory in four key swing states.
Republican lawmakers are getting behind the suit. Leading that effort on Capitol Hill is Congressman Mike Johnson. Let's talk about the suit. What's behind it?
There was a lot of irregularity, fraud, and hijinks, let's be frank about it. Look, we're going to have a landslide of House Republicans who are going to sign on to our amicus brief to support this.
Mike Johnson, then a little-known congressman from Louisiana, was the driving force behind congressional Republican efforts to overturn the 2020 election. He was the architect of a key part of Trump's legal strategy in trying to get election results thrown out. And when House Republicans eventually ousted Speaker Kevin McCarthy and ultimately settled on Mike Johnson to fill McCarthy's position, reporters tried to ask Johnson about his role in trying to overturn the election. This is what that looked like.
Mr. Johnson, you helped lead the efforts to overturn the 2020 election results.
Good job. Next question.
Republicans booing a reporter, telling her to shut up because they did not want to talk about Mike Johnson's role in the big lie. Flash forward to today. Mike Johnson has been Speaker of the House for nearly 6 months, and because the life cycle of a Republican House Speaker is roughly that of a fruit fly, Mike Johnson is already facing revolt among the far-right members of his own party. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has introduced a resolution to oust Speaker Johnson, the same way the MAGA hardliners ousted Kevin McCarthy. And so Speaker Johnson decided to try and shore up support from conservatives by embracing, once again, election lies. Today, the embattled speaker flew to Mar-a-Lago, where he and Donald Trump gathered reporters in a strange candelabra-filled room in Palm Beach to talk about election integrity. That is the party's preferred term for its lies about stolen elections. But Johnson and Trump weren't there to talk about the big lie that you may have grown accustomed to hearing about at this point. Instead, they offered a new version of the big lie, an updated version 2.0 that weaves together existing election conspiracies with Trump's other favorite conspiracy theory, the so-called migrant takeover of the United States.
Election integrity is tied to border, the lack of border security. Among the problems that flows from this open border catastrophe is directly related to this threat to our election integrity. We believe that one of their designs, one of the reasons for this open border, which everybody asks all around the country, why would they do this? Because they want to turn these people into voters.
Venezuela, it's happening with the Congo, it's happening with countries all over Africa, Asia, South America, all over the world it's happening. Our country is like a dumping ground.
They're coming from Venezuela, the Congo, Africa, Asia, South America. Democrats are shipping in brown people from all over the world to turn them into illegal voters. Elaborate and also wildly untrue. People who come to this country seeking a better life for themselves and their families do not willingly risk deportation just to vote for Democrats. It just does not happen. The Brennan Center for Justice analysis of the 2016 election found that out of 23.5 million votes cast, there were just 30 instances in which non-citizen votes were suspected. That's just the instances where it was suspected. The actual number is likely even smaller. Even conservative think tanks like the Cato Institute have found that non-citizens don't illegally vote in detectable numbers. But that reality doesn't matter to Donald Trump and Mike Johnson. They need an election lie that motivates their base. And so they've traded in the false conspiracies about black and brown people rigging the election in Atlanta and Detroit and Philadelphia for a new narrative, one where brown people from all over the global South are invading the United States just to vote for Democrats. And it's not just Mike Johnson and Donald Trump. The Republican National Committee, now led by Trump's daughter-in-law, Laura Trump, is now running robocalls pushing this exact same nonsense.
Hello, I'm Stephanie calling for the Republican National Committee co-chair Laura Trump. I'm sure you agree with co-chair Trump that we cannot allow the chaos and questions of the 2020 election to ever happen again. If Democrats have their way, your vote could be canceled out by someone who isn't even an American citizen.
As preposterous as this theory is, it appears to be convincing people, including some very influential people. One of the richest men in the world, Elon Musk, who I will note is himself an immigrant to the United States, has repeatedly pushed the false claim that Democrats are trying to ship in voters from other countries. Musk has blasted that message to his millions of followers on the social media platform he owns and controls. And now he will be assisted in this insanity by the leader of the House of Representatives and one of the two frontrunners for the U.S. presidency. Joining me now is Melissa Murray, MSNBC legal analyst and NYU law professor, and John Heilman, MSNBC national affairs analyst and host of the Hell and High Water podcast. Thank you both for being here this evening as we sift through the chaos once again of what happened to Mar-a-Lago. John,
that's one word for it.
Yeah, it's a family program. If you didn't like election, the big lie 1.0, there apparently is a 2.0. Is it an upgrade? What do you think of it? I mean, it's more outlandish. Is it more effective?
I mean, if the question is, does it animate Trump's base? Mm-hmm. It definitely does. If the question is, does it make voters who are in the middle of the electorate, who are a lot of the suburban voters who won the election for Joe Biden, along with big turnout from the base in 2020, and who, in a lot of quarters, have been drifting kind of, they're back towards Trump. They're in and out. They don't like Biden's economy. They're not with Biden. But every time that Trump does this kind of thing, it just reminds people of something in our amnesiac country that can't remember what happened last Tuesday. They can't, you know, Donald Trump wasn't so bad. The Trump years weren't so bad. We see this in the polling all the time. When Trump does this, it's making it about him. And when he makes it about him, he makes it about your word, chaos. And chaos in the suburbs of Philadelphia, in the suburbs of Milwaukee, in the suburbs of Atlanta, chaos is not what those kind of soft Republican voters want. It's why they ran away from him in 2020. And he keeps pushing it in their face.
Yeah.
It's a real risk for him politically, and I don't think it helps on net. I don't think it helps at all.
But, I mean, there is also the bigger question of what it does to our democracy, right? I mean, the after effect of 2020 and the big lie is voter suppression laws enacted across the country. And, when you hear about the RNC and these 18, they have 18 election integrity lawsuits across the country, there was a response to the preposterous falsehoods that were circulated by the Republican Party and Donald Trump, and state legislatures responded. Should we be paying more attention to this?
No, I think we have to pay more attention to this. It's not an unfamiliar trope that they are rehashing. It's not terribly original. It's the kind of thing that you typically would find cooked up in a meth lab of conservative grievance, this idea that all of these new Arivistes from the global south are replacing your vote. I mean, it's kind of a species of replacement theory. Yeah. And it's meant to trade on the same fears of demographic change and losing your country. And the response, I think, has been quite swift and immediate. There are more poll watchers who are now authorized to be there. And not only are they watching the polls, they might be intimidating certain voters from casting their votes. There are more laws now that require individuals to provide more proof to show that they are not non-citizens. And even though we know that the prospects of non-citizens voting is glancingly rare, the incentives are terrible for non-citizens to vote. You won't change the election with your vote, and you could be deported or go to jail. So, I mean, the incentives don't play out. But it has cashed out in a wave of laws that are designed to suppress the vote among certain voters under the auspices of limiting election fraud and election fraud that doesn't happen.
Yeah, that solving a problem that doesn't exist. There's also, when we compare it to 2020, John, I mean, you know, in the aftermath of January 6th, there was, for a minute at least, the institutional firmament of the GOP rejected the narrative that they rejected January 6th, and to some degree they rejected some of the big lie. That all changed. Kevin McCarthy went down to Mar-a-Lago, took a photo. There's not even that pretense anymore. Right. There is Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, having a press conference to talk about proposed legislation to deal with the problem that doesn't exist, which is more outlandish than I think, many other theories we've heard from the GOP.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, look, this is the least surprising thing in the world in the sense that Mike Johnson was one of the, was not just a follower, not just a lemming on the big lie and on the attempt to overturn the election. He was one of the primary architects of the big lie and the strategy to put in the fake electors. This is a guy who's been down with that program from the very beginning. It's part of the reason why he's speaker now. He has no other qualifications to be speaker. He doesn't know anything about the House and how it works. He's probably learned a few things in the however years since he's been speaker, but
It hasn't been that long
at this point. But he's not someone who, on the basis of anything else, would qualify. Unlike Kevin McCarthy, at least would put in all the time, who understood parliamentary procedure. Mike Johnson is there for one reason. He's the most big lie-ish, most MAGA-y candidate who survived that carnage that they inflicted on themselves a year ago. So to have him down there doing this is not surprising. I will say it's incredible, though, because just on a purely political basis, you don't get to stay speaker if Republicans don't keep control of the House.
Yeah.
And everything Donald Trump is doing, he wants to get rid of Obamacare. He shoots down the infrastructure, the immigration and border bill. He's tanking Ukraine aid. He's going against everything Mitch McConnell thinks is in the interest of the Republican majority. Donald Trump is tanking, including Mike Johnson's own FISA thing this week.
Humiliation is absolute.
It's incredible and it's politically toxic. He just does things that are by whim, by caprice, and that are, in his view, good for him. But he is guaranteeing with every move that the Republicans will not still be in the majority after November. And hey, Mike, guess what? If you're not the majority,
you're not the speaker.
You're not speaker anymore. So it's not even, it's craven politically, but it's also incredibly, it's like suicidal.
Yes, it's cutting off your nose and eating it to spite your face. I had to say that.
Melissa, yum.
To that end, the one thing that John left off that laundry list of like ridiculous things Republicans are taking a knee on at the behest of Donald Trump, abortion, right? In the same press conference, Trump is asked about his position. There's two pieces of sound, control room. I want to play the one where he talks about what is happening at the state level and the harmony therein. Can we please play that?
What we did was give it back to the states, and now the states are working their way through it. And you're having some very, very beautiful harmony, to be honest with you. You have some cases like Arizona that went back to like 1864 or something like that, and a judge made a ruling, but that's going to be changed by government.
Okay. First of all, it's not on the ballot yet. It would be changed by the voters, not the government. Is it a beautiful harmony? What was that?
So that was a word salad. If harmony is the sounds of women bleeding out in parking lots because they're septic and they can't get the treatment that they need after a miscarriage, and yeah, I guess that's harmony.
To Donald Trump's ears.
Well, I mean, this is someone who doesn't understand how government works, like literally how a bill becomes a law, and also has no idea what the reproductive cycle is. I mean, it's like, are you there, God? It's me, Donald Trump. And that's a real problem. But the Republicans are taking a knee on abortion in large part, I think, because Donald Trump knows he doesn't need a Republican House or a Republican Senate to further curtail abortion rights. We have this zombie Comstock law lying in wait, and all Donald Trump needs to reanimate that and to activate a nationwide ban on abortion, and indeed any implement that might be used for abortion, is to get his new Department of Justice with his new AG to begin reprioritizing the enforcement of the Comstock Act. So people need to get hip to that. He can afford to lose Mike Johnson. Mike Johnson is completely expendable because he can afford to lose Congress.
Right.
He can do this the other way, the way the hardcore members of his base would be happy to have him do it.
Well, and quite clearly, he doesn't want any actual Republican legislation to pass, which is why he's killing all of it in the run-up to the presidency.
You don't need a Republican legislature if you have
the
courts.
He has no interest in it. The governance doesn't seem to be of the essence here.
Right. It's minority rule.
Which is an argument that also applies to the thing that he cares about most of all, which is keeping himself out of prison.
Yes.
All he doesn't need a Republican House or a Republican Senate for that. He just needs that Attorney General, that sweet, sweet
Cash
Bill,
Patel.
The worst version of Bill Barr.
The other part of it, John, that just should not be ignored is he was asked about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't think we have time to play the sound, but we're going to keep you guys here for a long time tonight. We do have time. Let's play it.
Oh, yeah, good.
Do you support Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to vacate, or do you stand behind Speaker Johnson?
We're getting along very well with the speaker, and I get along very well with Marjorie. We have a speaker. He was voted in, and it was a complicated process, and I think very It's not not an easy situation for any speaker. I think he's doing a very good job. He's doing about as good as you're going to do. And I'm sure that Marjorie understands that. She's a very good friend of mine.
To have Donald Trump as your father figure, what must that be like?
Again, I say, if you're Mike Johnson and you watched what happened, Kevin McCarthy, who toadied to Donald Trump for years in order to say he would have my back. You know, I went to Mar-a-Lago, and when the chips are down, I'll have Trump behind me. Trump was like, see you later. I don't care about you, Kevin. Bye. Mike Johnson, does he think that this is going to, that Trump is going to come to his rescue when Trump quietly is saying to Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, take him out? He's not, Donald Trump is not going to be, dude, Mike, you know, earth to Mike Johnson. Donald Trump has betrayed everyone who has ever supplicated themselves in front of him. Everybody who does it, they all think somehow they're going to be different. They are never different. And Mike Johnson is definitely not going to be different.
Word to the wise. Melissa and John, you do not get to leave and have a Friday night quite yet. Please hang here for just a little bit longer, because coming up, I would like to get your thoughts on the eve of the first criminal trial of a former president. Jury selection begins Monday, and one of the key potential witnesses for the prosecution says there are some surprises in store. Plus, Arizona Senate candidate and Trump vice presidential shortlister Carrie Lake is having a really bad week. Stay with us.
Why do you believe it is important for you to testify, take the stand in this upcoming trial?
Well, I'm testifying. I tell the truth. I mean, all I can do is tell the truth.
Donald Trump is just a few days away from his very first criminal trial. Earlier today, at his press conference, Trump asserted that he will take the stand in the New York City hush money trial, which appears to be both predictable and a very bad idea. Here's Michael Cohen, Trump's former fixer and a potential star witness for the prosecution, in an interview with Politico correspondent Ryan Lizza.
Do you think he wants to testify?
Well, I think he'd like you to believe that he would.
You think it would be a disaster?
Disaster. Donald does not know how to tell the truth.
Cohen also predicts that Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has some surprises in store.
Credibility is one part of this trial. You've talked about that. The other C word that comes up is corroboration. What can you tell us about that? Is this a stronger case when it comes to corroboration than people understand on the outside?
If it wasn't, I assure you and your listeners that Alvin Bragg and his team of prosecutors would never have brought this case.
Do you think we'll be surprised by some of the corroborating evidence?
I do.
Back with me are Melissa Murray and John Heilman. Melissa, first, let's just tackle the latest news of today, which is that Trump saying seemingly definitively that he is going to testify at the trial. Can you paint a picture of the disaster that might be for him?
It's very unorthodox for any criminal defendant to take the stand in her own defense because, again, in a criminal trial, the burden is on the government to prove the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a very high standard. Any kind of doubt can be room for a jury to acquit. And so the defendant doesn't have to do anything. The burden is on the prosecution. So stepping in and giving the prosecution an opportunity to cross-examine you, to poke holes in your story, and to shore up their own story, disastrous. Most lawyers would tell their clients, no, do not do this. But again, most lawyers don't have Donald Trump as a client. And as Michael Cohen said, this has got to be really nerve-wracking for the defense team, because this is a man who consistently shows that he loves to talk, he loves to talk about himself, and he's not particularly tethered to the truth when he does so.
That is being generous. And John, when we think about the hush money trial, in some ways it's a story we've heard before. It goes to the sort of essence of Trump as a national character, as a New York character. I'll read a quote from David Corn. The trial casts a light on an important slice of Trump's origin story, his cultivation of a sordid and crude celebrity infused with misogyny. My question to you is, like, does that have an effect on the American public at this point? Are we used to it, or is it a negative reminder of all the sort of distasteful things about Trump that will have a meaningful effect on the election?
There's a poetic kind of justice to this being the first Trump trial. So if you're thinking about this as a narrative, you know, and particularly if we actually thought that we would get the January 6th trial or the classified documents trial in time for the election, I could go with the argument of like, it's great that this is the first one, because it really is kind of going in sequence and we get to see the character and then we get to see what he did in office. This was pre-presidency. Then we get presidency. Then we get post-presidency. That'd be a great
triptych.
Story. Yeah. It'd be like the right way to tell the story about this guy. I think that as of the three of them, it's the one that has the least political consequence. It's not the one that you would, if you were like, we can only get one of these trials done before Election Day. Which one do we want? I think it's not the one you would pick. And I think that doesn't mean it doesn't matter to people. And I think that, you know, we've seen some polling that suggests that, you know, 2/3 of the country thinks this is a serious charge, doesn't dismiss the charge. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, if you go out and talk to people in the country about it, it's not the thing that for Trump voters obviously don't care. Democrats already understand Trump's misogynist, he's tawdry and all that stuff. And there's these people in the middle who I think have lots of problems with Trump and have things that they find repulsive about him and dangerous. They don't necessarily think that paying hush money to a porn star is the reason that they're going to not vote for him. They're more likely, if you could demonstrate that, you know, Donald Trump was a seditionist and was convicted of that, man, that's probably a ball game. And I think the classified documents case also is just a very clear cut thing. Presidents should not be doing this. And a lot of people have a lot of respect for that. This gets more into maybe priced into the stock.
Sleazy, but maybe not disqualifying. There's going to be new stuff, though. I mean, it seems quite obvious that Alvin Bragg is going to be presenting new evidence, new witnesses. It's not just going to be the Michael Cohen song and dance.
No, I think that's right. I don't disagree with what you say, John, but I would say part of the reason why this feels a little low rent to a lot of voters is how we talk about it. I mean, there's something salacious about it. There's something tawdry about it. But when you look at it, and Andrew and I talk about this in our book, like when you look about this, when you look at this in sort of the sweep of the four indictments, it's like he's gearing up with this one. And it's sort of a pattern and practice of doing anything to get what you want. And that was something that marked his presidency. You know, we saw like in these moments where the Supreme Court would strike down things that the Trump administration did, it was because they literally would do anything to get the outcome, even if it meant circumventing the normal channels that you had to go through. And this is kind of the same thing. January 6th is just a more elaborate version of that. To just stay in power, I literally will allow insurrectionists into the Capitol. So this is just the beginning of a pattern and practice. And I think if you talk about it like that, maybe that moves the needle and gets the public animated about the other trials that they're probably not going to see.
Can I follow on then and ask just like what your expectation is for Bragg, who by all accounts, there was a big New York Times Magazine profile on him, is a very methodical individual, risk averse. You heard Michael Cohen saying he would never brought this case if it was just what you know now. Like, this guy has done his homework. What's your expectation?
I think almost any prosecutor said, I mean, the burden is so high on the prosecution to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt that you don't just bring anything before a jury. I mean, you really have to believe that your case is airtight, that you can tell this story to 12 people and they're all going to be with you at the end. And so, you know, Alvin Bragg, he's a really good lawyer. The folks on his team are good lawyers. Matthew Colangelo, the senior prosecutor on this, former clerk to Justice Sotomayor. He's a real lawyer doing real things. He's not going to be a fly-by-night guy. He's methodical too. They are buttoned up on this. And so I kind of believe, Michael Cohen, that there are things that we're not expecting that may come out in the course of this that bolster this case, perhaps more so than we're expecting.
Prosecutors also do not like to lose. And
yeah.
Like being the one who took the shot on the first Donald Trump criminal trial and then failing, you know, just your ego in that is at stake. And I think that's one other reason why you think, man, the guy wants to win.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. Alvin Bragg's not going out here to lose. Melissa Murray, John Heilman, thank you for spending a sizable portion of your Friday evening with me. I'm deeply appreciative. Still ahead tonight, Republicans are desperately trying to distance themselves from the abortion bans they very recently championed. And Vice President Kamala Harris is not going to let them off the hook. That is next.
We thought that when you said you supported the 1864 ban, you meant it. Why such a drastic change in the way you talked about it? I want to know what you say to people who trusted you and believed in you, and why are you against that America?
Well, let me thank you for the question. First of all, I am pro-life.
This has not been a good week for Republican Senate candidate and Trump ally Carrie Lake. On Tuesday, Arizona's top court reinstated an abortion ban from 160 years ago. When slavery was the law of the land, only white men could vote, and Arizona wasn't actually a state. The ban criminalizes virtually all abortions, with no exceptions for rape or incest, and Carrie Lake was a big proponent of that law.
I'm incredibly thrilled that we are going to have a great law that's already on the books, so it will prohibit abortion in Arizona.
That was 2 years ago, when Carrie Lake was running for Arizona governor. But now, when she is running for Arizona senator, the great law has actually become the law of the land, and it is deeply, profoundly unpopular. So yesterday, Carrie Lake changed her mind.
But if you look at where the population is on this, a full ban on abortion is not where the people are. The issue is less about banning abortion and more about saving babies.
Are you following this? Pro-life Carrie Lake, who previously called the Civil War era abortion ban a great law, is now claiming that the law is not where the people are. She even reportedly called on Arizona state legislators to repeal it, which has landed her in some very hot water with conservative anti-choice voters. And that is what you saw in that clip we played earlier, where she's getting booed, effectively. It could have just ended there, but it didn't. To prove her credentials with the allegedly pro-family wing of her party, Lake this week touted a new and amazing policy.
In Hungary, what they did I thought was so amazing. They started with their tax rate. And when you get married, they give you a cut in your tax rate. When you have your first child, they give you another cut. By the time a mother has four children, she never pays taxes again. That's called a baby bonus. I think we should do that here in America.
Okay, first of all, the reason Hungary's authoritarian dictator Viktor Orban is trying to encourage native mothers to have multiple offspring is because he is engaged in a white Christian nationalist project of repopulating his country with white Christians. And as part of that, he has pursued an aggressively fascistic agenda of keeping out black and brown migrants. Setting all of that aside, the policy that Carrie Lake thinks is so amazing, that tax cut for people who have kids, is literally something we have here in America. It's called the Child Tax Credit, and lawmakers have recently proposed expanding it. But right now, right at this very moment, in fact, the Senate and Senate Republicans in particular are trying to block it. Here's the quote. Senate Republicans are inching closer to burying a bipartisan bill to expand the Child Tax Credit. The top Republican in the Senate Finance Committee said it would create too much entitlement. It appears that Carrie Lake's know-nothingness about reproductive health care extends to a know-nothingness about a lot of other things, too. And that has not escaped the notice of Democrats. Earlier today, Vice President Kamala Harris took this issue right to Carrie Lake's doorstep in Arizona to make Lake and the Republican Party answer for their hypocrisy. I'll talk more about that with Lisa Lehrer from The New York Times coming up next.
Just like he did in Arizona, he basically wants to take America back to the 1800s.
That's right. That's right.
But we are not going to let that happen.
Today at a campaign rally in Tucson, Arizona, Vice President Kamala Harris went on the offensive. Just 3 days after Arizona's Supreme Court ruled that the state's 1864 abortion ban is enforceable, Vice President Harris made it abundantly clear that there is one person responsible for all of this, former President Donald Trump. She also argued that women's rights and basic freedoms depend on keeping Trump out of the White House.
Overturning Roe was just the opening act, of a larger strategy to take women's rights and freedoms. Former President Donald Trump did this. Because of Donald Trump, one in three women of reproductive age in our country live in a state that has a Trump abortion ban. And now Trump wants us to believe he will not sign a national ban. Enough with the gaslighting. It is your power that will put this right in the Arizona State Constitution. And it is your power that will send Joe Biden and me back to the White House.
Joining me now is Lisa Lehrer, national political correspondent for The New York Times and co-author of the forthcoming book, The Fall of Roe, The Rise of a New America, which comes out in June. Lisa, it's great to have you here. I'm such a fan of your reporting on all of this. And you had some really interesting reporting ahead of this event.
Yes.
About how Vice President Harris made this event. It went from kind of an official White House event to a campaign event. And sort of my question to you would be, for a while now, we've heard about the Biden-Harris campaign toggling between different topics as the sort of big difference makers in the election. Democracy, the economy. Mm-hmm. It sort of feels like they're coalescing around abortion as being a very powerful motivator in November.
Yeah, and what top Biden campaign strategists tell me is it is a really powerful motivator, and it's a powerful motivator across the board. Like, sure, it's perhaps more energizing for certain groups in their coalition, young voters, female voters. But there's no one that doesn't, there's no Biden voter or voter who is available to Biden. So Democrats certainly, but also independents, even some moderate Republicans, particularly moderate Republican women, who does not feel motivated by this. And they also see abortion as symbolic of more than just the right to terminate a pregnancy. It's also sort of this, they see it as symbolic of freedoms and bodily autonomy and these other things that really connect deeply with people in this moment.
Well, right. And it dovetails with democracy, right? Bodily right. autonomy, freedom.
Totally.
And it is an economic issue, whether or not you can have a child or are forced to have a child. I do wonder, you know, as we talk about like how Biden makes sense of this and who is delivering the message. Biden himself has had a sort of complicated relationship,
yes.
shall we say, with the right. topic of abortion stretching back to his days as a senator. Is it your sense that Harris is going to be leading the charge on this? I mean, she certainly seems to have a sensitivity to how relevant it is and,
yes.
and a way of talking about it that is like particularly pointed and passionate.
And what our reporting found was that she's eager to do this. She sees this as a core issue to the campaign, as something they have to fight on, and she's really concerned that Trump is going to muddy the water somehow
mm-hmm.
and try to demonstrate that he wouldn't go further, and she believes that he would go further, that he would endorse some kind of national ban, either through Congress or through the Comstock Act. You know, Biden, the interesting thing about Biden is I actually think he's thought more deeply about abortion than any president I can remember. He's really struggled with this issue and struggled between his politics and what he believes is the correct policy and his faith. And we really document that as, you know, in part of our book. But it is interesting. And I think he's even evolved since Dobbs in this post-Roe mm-hmm. era to become more of a champion of perhaps not a procedure that he himself would get if he was still in the market for such things,
yeah.
but as an available right, as something that American women should have.
Well, and I think he can see himself in other Americans, or other Americans can
right.
maybe see themselves in Joe Biden, right? Like these stories of women who are going septic or being
yes.
forced to get nearly septic in order to get basic health care because of these abortion provisions in state constitutions or state law. I mean, that's changed the partisan divide on all of this. You know, one of the things that I think is so striking about this week, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on why this case in Arizona has been so resonant, is that Donald Trump comes out on Monday saying, my
right.
big reveal here is leave it to the states, right?
Right?
That's my big plan to sort of curry favor with independents and moderates. And then on Tuesday, we see what happens when it's left to the states. Is the timing of that particularly difficult for Republicans? Is that why Democrats are seizing on it? Is that why it's been so widely discussed? What's your assessment?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. I think certainly the timing of Trump's announcement and then this law coming out, it just was a perfect political storm for Democrats to seize on. I also do think there's something about this happening in Arizona. I think Americans have a sense or an expectation, for better or worse, that these kinds of bans happen in deep red states. The case that undid Roe, Dobbs, of course, took place in Mississippi.
You know, obviously, we were talking a few weeks ago about Alabama and access to IVF, but this is Arizona. This is a swing state. This is a place that's had explosive growth in recent years. It is not a deep, people don't think of it, and it is not a deep red state. And I think that gives a sense, at least the Biden campaign believes, I should say, their strategist, that that gives a sense that this is something that's creeping closer and closer to people's lives, that more and more people have heard these stories of women who have faced these really heart-wrenching medical and, you know, emotional decisions. And it's becoming more and more present, that the drumbeat of headlines and court rulings just continues to reinforce what a post-Roe America is.
Yeah, the tide is creeping. And I think now North Carolina, one of the Democratic candidates for governor, said this is the southernmost state where abortion is still legal. Lisa Lehrer from The New York Times, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for your time tonight. Coming up, Trump's co-defendants in the classified documents case were in court before Judge Eileen Cannon today, saying they were only taking orders from the big guy and they should have their charges dismissed. Judge Cannon's response, that's next. At Mar-a-Lago on May 26, 2022, Trump's valet, Walt Nauta, told Trump he was going for a jog, but he wasn't. He was sneaking away to talk to the FBI. And yesterday, we got the transcript of that FBI interview, and it has some fascinating color in it, like how the FBI agents talked to Nauta about the TV show How I Met Your Mother and were all buddy-buddy with him to get him to relax. But of course, the focus of the interview was more substantive. They asked Nauta about his involvement in the movement of boxes and whether he had seen any classified information. And that interview is now newly relevant because today in court, Walt Nauta and his co-defendant, Trump property manager Carlos de Oliveira, today in court, they tried to have some of the charges against them dropped in the Trump classified documents case. The crux of their argument is that they shouldn't be guilty of obstructing justice because they claim they didn't know there was an investigation happening in the first place. They didn't know what they were moving. They were just following orders. The main issue with that is that 1 week after Walt Nauta was interviewed by the FBI about moving boxes that could have classified information in them, Nauta and De Oliveira moved boxes for Trump again. So, does their argument today have legs? Or is it as made up as Walt Nauta's jog? Joining me now is Mark Zaid, an attorney with expertise in national security, security clearances, and government investigations, just like the one Trump, Nauta, and De Oliveira now find themselves in. Mark, thank you for joining me tonight. And I kind of wonder what you make of this argument that De Oliveira and Nauta were just following orders, despite the fact that they did have a meeting with the FBI where the FBI was pretty clear about what was in those boxes.
Sure. Good evening, Alex. Pleasure to be here. I don't like the I'm just following orders argument. It makes me think of World War II and the Nazis, and we know how that turned out, which I'm not making the equivalence, obviously, with what this situation is. But pretty much as Judge Cannon was describing, as much as one can assess from the bench how a judge reacts, this is mostly a fact and trial issue. I mean, today's hearing was a very routine, typical, expected defense motions to dismiss charges, try and get additional information. But it really comes down to, is it a fact or not? You know, did they know? Did they not know? It could be a viable defense that could ultimately lead to their acquittal, but that will be for a jury to decide, likely not this judge.
Yeah, you mentioned get more information. It sounds like they want a bill of particulars. Now, I'm just a student in TV law school, so bear with me. But a bill of particulars, as I understand it, is essentially an itemized list of every illegal action the government, the special counsel, believes Nauta and De Oliveira took. And Smith has some thoughts about why Nauta and De Oliveira would want this bill of particular. He alleges that Nauta's motion asks how the government will prove facts at trial and is therefore a thinly veiled attempt to get the government to disclose its trial strategy. Do you agree with that?
I mean, look, it's very typical from both sides. I mean, this part of the case is a normal criminal case. I mean, we're dealing with conspiracy allegations, concealment of documents, obstruction of justice, false statements. It doesn't have to even involve classified or national defense information. This is the non-sexy part of this case. So the defense is trying to get more information. The prosecution is trying to prevent that from happening. This is a very detailed indictment superseding to bring in Oliveira. So in this sense, no, you know, whatever. This is just them going back and forth. What we're really waiting for is more proceedings with respect to the Classified Information Procedures Act, where Trump's next submission is due by May 9th, where they're actually, though we won't see it as the public, but the court will start to learn what type of classified information or what specific documents former President Trump's legal team wants to present at the trial. This is where we'll get into the meat of whether this case will actually be successful for the prosecution or successful for Trump.
Just from the outside, Mark, it feels like Cannon is really considering everything at a pretty leisurely pace. I mean, Smith is accusing now to Andy Oliveira of these motions as being dilatory tactics that were paving the way for more delays. I know that you said this is kind of a pro forma exercise. This is what happens. But the fact that we're kind of having these hearings for all these motions, I mean, does it feel like the judge at least is slow rolling this?
Look, it certainly feels that way. We still do not know when the trial will be. It's still technically set for May 20th. Obviously, that is not going to happen. There is a possibility Smith, special counsel, has asked for July. The defense has said they can deal with August. We'll see. I'll take my chances going to the casinos and winning before I predict when I think this trial will actually occur. But there's a lot of back and forth gamesmanship. Could this case go more quickly? Absolutely. There were delays with respect to motions that were unnecessarily, and at least from the outside perspective. I will say that these types of Espionage Act cases, again, not what we were hearing about today, but, you know, there's a lot that needs to go into these very difficult, complicated cases involving classified information. You add in a former president of the United States, you can kind of understand why it's taking so long. But obviously, a lot of people want this to happen before the election in order for those to factor that into the decision. That's clearly not what this judge is contemplating. And I don't know if that's necessarily inappropriate, because that's not relevant to the criminal part of it. So for many people, this is going too slow. And for many people, it's going too fast. I'm just trying to watch it as a matter of law to understand what is happening. And eventually we will find out.
A very generous assessment of Judge Aileen Cannon, Mark. We'd love to talk with you more about it, but we have to leave it there tonight. Thanks for your time.
I try.
That is our show for tonight.